This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from Queen's College, joined by Leslie Hinkson of Georgetown University and Gabriel Rossman of UCLA. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Today, we're very, very excited to be speaking with Robert Woodnow, professor of sociology at Princeton University. Professor Woodnow is one of the discipline's leading experts on culture, religion, morality, and community. He's written more books than we have time to list, and we're going to talk about his most recent work, The Left Behind, Decline and Rage in Rural America, with Princeton University Press. We're going to talk about small-town America, disaffect in rural communities, their relationship with government and politics, and a lot more. There's no way you're going to want to miss this. Thank you for joining us, Bob. Can we kick it off by having you tell us about your book? What's it about?
Well, this book was the result of about 10 years of working on various aspects of rural America. This was, of course, well before we realized that in the 2016 election that we might become interested in rural America in a new way. I got interested because I grew up in a small town in the middle of nowhere in Kansas and was always sort of curious about the path not taken. And so I started out looking at what was happening both in rural areas and in cities in the Midwest. And then that gravitated to a larger study of people in small towns across the country. Did another project on just farm families and then began to piece together things from all of those projects. So altogether, we realized, and when I say we, it was a project that included the help of probably a dozen or so research assistants located in different parts of the country. We realized that we had talked to about 1,000 people altogether, done qualitative interviews with a huge number of people. And so at one point, the folks at Princeton University Press, who I'd been working with, came around and said, you know, we've been talking to people at conferences and everybody's kind of saying, you know, we don't really know what's going on in rural America. We haven't thought about that very much. And would it be possible to, they asked me to put together something fairly short, hopefully fairly readable that might summarize some of the main points. So that's the background to the book.
1,000 interviews, that's almost like, if you just coded it, that's like a quantitative sample size. That's a huge
I was just thinking
sample
that.
For qualitative.
What's great about the book, though, is I enjoyed it. I'm also from a small town. The one thing that I liked is it dug into the deep reasoning why people in rural America are often thought to have a disaffect for the system. They're like the roots of their anger and their rage. And often the narrative is that they're country bumpkins or manipulated. But I like how you didn't have to resort to those types of stereotypes, and you did dig deeper to something that rang true. So my question is, why are rural Americans upset? What's the source of disaffect?
Well, what I argue in the book is that rural Americans are really very loyal to their communities. Yes, they are in some ways a rugged individualist that appreciate their independence, like to do what they want to do. But they do live in small places. They either live in small communities or they live near those communities. And those communities are very much for them moral communities, meaning this in the sense that we sociologists understand from Emil Durkheim, communities of obligation, communities that create and reinforce a kind of identity. And it's that sense of community that people living in those communities like, cherish, value, and at the same time feel is being threatened. Threatened just by social changes, mm-hmm. The fact that there are fewer jobs in rural communities, the fact that people in those communities are aging. The population is aging because younger people are leaving to go to college or to get jobs. The fact that in many communities, about 40% of all rural communities under 25,000 people, about 40% of those have been losing population. And so there's a sense of decline. And people understand why that's happening. They try to work at things they can do to help the community. But they're also angry about it. And it's partly that they're angry about losing a way of life that they value. Mm-hmm. They're also angry at various threats they perceive of facing their communities. One of those threats that came up over and over again in the interviews is the federal government. Mm-hmm. Washington is broken, they kept saying. And what they mean by that is that Washington, they think, should be helping. They understand that what happens in Washington affects them, you know, whether it's Social Security or Medicare or trade policies or agricultural policies, whatever it might be. They think Washington should be helping. They also, though, think that Washington should understand them a little better than it does. They think, well, you know, common sense locally is what matters. People sort of figure things out. We're pragmatic. We solve our problems here as best we can, but we don't see that happening in Washington because it's so far away and the bureaucracies are too big to understand, too cumbersome. Yes. So they feel that Washington is distant, but at the same time, they also then are angry because Washington is, for some of them, the way they think about it, is intruding on their life. Right. It is passing unfunded mandates that they have to worry about, or it is favoring immigrants and they don't appreciate that, or it is favoring people in cities, or passing regulations about the environment that they feel are restricting what they can do. Right. So a lot of their anger focuses on Washington.
When you talked about like anger about trade, you know, my understanding, especially you see this now with the discussion of China retaliating over aluminum and steel, is that farmers generally benefit from U.S. trade policy, and that, you know, exports of agricultural commodities has been a big success story. Are these farmers generally protectionists notwithstanding that, or are they generally in favor of trade? How do they feel about that?
They're generally in favor of trade, have been for a long time. Most of the family farmers we talked to were second or third or even fourth generation farmers. They were in the business, or their parents had been in the business long enough that they knew, they remembered, that the worst farm crisis in recent history was in the 1970s when Jimmy Carter imposed an embargo on exports to Russia. And they're still recovering from that, some of them. If you look at income levels, foreclosures and so forth, there was a huge farm crisis at that point. And so they are totally 100% for free trade. This was true of smaller farmers, larger farmers. Where it varied to some extent was the degree to which the agricultural produce that they're engaged with is in fact exportable. So for instance, the small grain farmers, the wheat, the corn, the soybeans, they were totally interested in free trade. Many of the big farmers doing that kind of business actually were members of statewide or regional trade commissions. Some of the larger ones actually were farming outside of the United States as well as inside. We talked to a corn farmer in Iowa who had a big farm in Brazil. We talked to a cotton farmer in Texas who had done a lot of work helping Saudi Arabia with its cotton farming. Yeah. You know, so they were not the country bumpkins that you know, sometimes get portrayed. So what they're thinking now about some of the, you know, new trade restrictions, tariffs, and so forth. Already, you know, as I've sampled a little bit, some of the farm journals and blogs and so forth, they're not very happy about it.
How many of these grievances are kind of like broad culture war issues that basically people don't experience necessarily in their everyday lives, but they hear about on the news, And, you know, you hear on the news that basically, you know, the government made some type of statement or enacted some type of policy that symbolically, you know, lowers your status, but doesn't necessarily have a concrete impact on your life. And you wouldn't necessarily even have heard about it if not through the news. And how much of it is like concrete policies that immediately have it? So I, what I have in mind with that later type of thing is in the Central Valley of California, a lot of farmers are mad at the federal government because the federal government has created policies for they're not allowing people to take river water because it hurts the habitat of this tiny little fish. And so crops are dying all through Central Valley of California because of the federal government's Endangered Species Act type stuff. So how much of it is basically, you know, stuff they hear about through the news, and how much of it is like, you know, immediate policies that directly affect their lives?
It's both. It really is. And if one thinks about the rural population, broadly speaking, the 50 million people approximately who live in rural America, I'd have to say on the basis of the interviews we did that it was more often the broad cultural issues, sometimes the symbolic issues, sometimes things that were simply in the news, things that Rush Limbaugh had talked about or that they'd heard about on Fox News, things that symbolically represented a challenge to their way of life. To the idea that you can, as a local citizen, kind of make up your mind about things, that if you, for instance, have been used to having a Christmas pageant that was in the town square, fine, do that. If you happen to have a prayer in the schools, fine, do that. Or even on a broader issue, if you were concerned about abortion or pornography or whatever it might be, that was a grievance. So that came through over and over again. And for people like that, it didn't have very much to do with specific policies, which meant that, for instance, if they happened to feel now at this moment that some particular economic policy coming out of Washington wasn't in their favor, it wouldn't matter because it was those larger symbolic issues. The exception, and Gabe, this kind of goes directly to your point about the Central Valley farmers, the exception usually was the farmers because their day-to-day life is so closely tied with the federal government. I mean, they have to report, for instance, to the tenth of an acre exactly what they're planting to the county farm service agency, the county FSA. They have to, of course, as business people, report things in great detail. So the farmers we talked to were uniformly very well informed, at least about farm policies. And so it did matter to them if there was something specific, either in terms of, let's say, general farm subsidies or crop insurance programs, or something very specific. For instance, one farmer was very upset because he had a tank, a fuel tank, and it was a fairly large tank because he was storing whatever it was, gasoline or diesel, and he was being required to put to create a ditch around it, you know, in case it spilled. Well, you know, it sort of made sense in terms of environment, but he was a small enough farmer that it was going to cost him a lot of money to do that. And that was one of many cases we heard where the small to medium sized family farmers were saying, you know, that's basically making it harder and harder and harder for us to stay in business. And so it's going to be the big industrial farms that come in and take over and drive us out of business. So that was an example. One other quick example, it didn't always have to do with grievances against the federal government. There was one case that I wrote about that kind of amused me because it was simply a grievance that the state government, the state highway department, had not put up a sign out out on the interstate, you know, directing tourist traffic into their town, and they were mad as hell about it.
So Bob, I have a question. In listening to you describe what seems to be going on in rural communities based on your many, many interviews, I'm wondering how much of this story is specific to rural communities, and how much of it is just a trend that we're seeing more broadly across different types of communities in the United States. I was struck by your description because, you know, I grew up in a low-income, working-class, urban community in Brooklyn, and, you know, this sense of it being a moral community, this sense of, you know, our way of life is especially now seen as being under attack with, you know, extreme gentrification. The government should be doing a little bit more. The federal government should be doing a little bit more, as well as our local government, doing a little bit more to help in terms of housing, and also in terms of, decriminalizing things like marijuana possession and really just sort of revamping the whole criminal justice system. So how much of this is a rural story and how much of it is different segments, of the American population, feeling as though, you know what, the government isn't actually working for me, and by the government, primarily the federal government?
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think this is primarily a rural story. It is, I would certainly argue, partly a rural story because there has been over the years and perhaps increasingly in the last few decades a kind of othering of rural America. You know, the kind of stereotypes, and a lot of the people we talked to were aware of those stereotypes, you know, that people would come out from cities and they'd speak louder because they weren't sure rural people could hear them, or they'd ask, you know, questions like, you know, so do you have indoor plumbing now? You know, things like that. But I also think that part of what we're seeing in the current political context is an unnecessarily sharp divide in the way we talk about urban America and rural America, because you're absolutely right, Leslie, that lots of people in urban neighborhoods, in suburbs, feel the same way about Washington being broken. They want to drain the swamp. They're concerned. They feel that the federal government isn't helping them. We know that from polls. We know that from a lot of ethnographic studies. And yet at the same time, the punditry has kind of jumped on this bandwagon that, well, rural America is just so different from urban America that somehow that's the issue. Whereas in fact, if there are two things. If you look at the quantitative data, when you see the headlines that, well, you know, poverty is worse in rural America now, teen pregnancy is worse in rural America, drug addiction is worse in rural America, and so forth, the percentage points are often very small. And as we're taught to think as sociologists, the within variation is often greater than the between variation when you think about those categories. And I certainly noticed, wrote about, you know, the huge variations that there are across regions, even between people who live in a town of 5,000 people and people who live in a town of 20,000 people, people who live in a predominantly African-American community or a predominantly Hispanic community or a white Caucasian community, all of those differences, and those often get blurred. So that's an important part of the story too.
One interesting thing that came through in your book is I often compare the American communities you profile with the Canadian community that I'm from, and there are some stark differences. For example, there's an attitude, at least in my home community, which is reliably NDP, which is like socialist, that you can't get a nice airport or you can't get a nice bus station or infrastructure investment without the government's help. Like where there's a sense that we rely on transfers from Toronto, let's say. And so the attitude is very positive to redistribution. And I think there's people look towards the government to help them. Why is it different? Is it that Let me rephrase my question. My sense is that one of the big differences, or there are two big differences. One is religion is less strong, at least in the part of Canada that I'm from, and that people aren't fed a steady stream of media that is sort of inciting people to be angry at others, immigrants or the city or things like that. And I feel like that's a steady diet. How much of that, sort of incitement and religion, do you think help explain why rural Americans have the attitudes they do?
Absolutely crucial. I understand too. I have relatives in Canada, and we go back and forth on precisely this. You know, why is Canada so civilized about so many things, and the U.S. is not? I do think it's absolutely true that both the media and religion make a difference. One of the things I tried to pick up in the interviews and also in traveling around and spending time in small towns was, you know, just what is in the background. Who are people quoting? Or if you're sitting having an interview at McDonald's, is the television on? And yes, the polarized media really does make a difference. And, you know, frankly, now as we're hearing news about Sinclair Broadcasting, you know, taking over so many, local TV stations and so forth, that's concerning. Media is part of it. Religion is too. What happens with religion is that, and we talk to a lot of pastors and priests, what happens is that the megaphone that religion has in small communities is often quite loud, partly because church attendance is actually a little bit higher in rural communities by and large than in urban communities, but partly because the churches, and it usually is churches, of course there's the occasional mosque, the occasional synagogue, but the churches are well integrated with the rest of the community. People who are leaders in the church, whether it's the clergy or lay leaders, are also involved with the school board and the Kiwanis Club and the Chamber of Commerce and whatever it might be. Also, the pastors are usually among the more articulate folks in the community. They have a built-in audience. And some of those pastors for a long time have been involved in the pro-life movement, more recently in the Tea Party movement, maybe especially in states that have been red states for a long time, Republican states. They have also been involved in local politics, or at least they're very closely related to, sometimes literally related to, people who are in politics. So yes, the churches do make quite a big difference. And a lot of times it is an interesting alliance between conservative Catholics and conservative Protestants. And that's been one of the results of the pro-life movement over the last 30 years or so, that it's formed that alliance that didn't used to be there between Protestants and Catholics.
Yeah, I wanted to circle back to a comment that you made earlier, Bob, when you were talking about the within group variation. And I'm wondering, how much of your argument is focusing primarily on majority white rural areas? And would your story be different if you were, you know, just talking to, predominantly black rural communities, because those do exist, or communities that are heavily Latino, or rural communities that are heavily Asian? Do you think your findings would be different?
Yes, and I know that because we did do interviews in predominantly African American communities and predominantly Hispanic communities. And what you find is that even in, let's say, talking to people in the same community who are of different races or ethnic groups, is that the story is indeed quite different. This isn't surprising, but it is different. One example, and there's one of the communities that I profile in the book is a southern community. It's a Gulf community. I don't give the actual name of it, but it is a very mixed race community. You talk to the white people there, it's a story in their view of them basically promoting racial progress. And their evidence of that is, well, you know, it didn't used to be that there were any African Americans on the town council, and now there is one. Or, you know, it didn't used to be that the schools were integrated at all, and now they sort of are. You know, so they're kind of, you know, giving that spin on it, and that certainly wasn't what the African American people told us. They told us, you know, much more about the continuing prejudice and the uphill battle for jobs and representation. And of course, they usually were not in power, although we did talk to African American mayors and town managers and clergy. But because of the power dynamics that we've all known about for years and years that are still there in small communities, they were having to look much more to the outside and to state or usually federal government help to rectify some of those, you know, local forms of discrimination. With Hispanic communities, it was interesting. We did interview people in some communities in Texas and in California that had been predominantly Hispanic for a long time. But the more interesting, to me at least, were some of the communities that had become majority in recent years. And those were in the South and in the Midwest. And in those communities, the interesting dynamic mostly had to do with the pace of change. So communities that had, over a very short period of time, become minority majority, usually because of a sudden opening of a food processing plant, you know, a poultry processing plant or a beef plant or some such thing. Those communities had really struggled. The Hispanics and the Anglos, you know, just both had a lot of difficulties. And there had been a huge amount of white Anglo flight in those communities. The ones, and I actually do talk about one by name, Garden City, Kansas, that's been studied several times by several teams of sociologists. That was an interesting case because they had made the transition over a long period of time. The largest meat processing plant in the world moved there in 1980, so they've had quite a while since then. But even before that, there had been a sugar processing plant for most of the 20th century, and even before that, the railroad came through, and some of the Hispanics and African Americans who had worked on the railroad stayed. There had been an NAACP chapter for years and years and years, and despite the fact that they've had some of the stereotypic difficulties, you know, concerns about crimes, concerns about language, education in the schools, new immigration, undocumented workers, and so forth, that community's actually made the transition pretty well. But to the main point, Leslie, absolutely, it makes a huge difference. And it is true that the rural population is more white Anglo, somewhere between 85 and 90% than urban America, but there is a lot of diversity as well.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, I've often thought about this, and actually, I mean, I've actually read other people write about this, but I was wondering what you'd have to say to our listeners about this point. Sorry for my roundabout way of asking the question, but for a really long time, farmers were incredibly integral to, you know, sort of the life and the health, you know, and of this country as well as its economy. And, you know, that's not to say that they aren't anymore. It's just, as you mentioned earlier, you know, there are these huge agribusinesses now that have come in to take over that role. And I'm wondering how much of this disaffection this feeling of disaffection has to do with all of a sudden, not even all of a sudden, but gradually, you know, people starting to realize that the rest of the country doesn't look at them in this way anymore.
We heard that a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Farmers would tell us, and sometimes people in small towns who weren't farmers, but who understood the local economy was agricultural, would tell us that, yeah, people need to understand, you know, that their food comes from us. One of the quotes was, you know, well, they may not be thinking about us as farmers, but they ought to, because at least three times a day, you know, they're benefiting from what we produce. And they felt that way. Even if they were very small farmers and were, let's say, producing wheat or maybe soybeans or, let's say, corn that was mostly going to ethanol rather than to food, but they still thought of themselves as being integral to everybody's lives and to the economic life of the society. What bothered them, of course, was that agriculture has become such a matter of agribusiness. They knew they were dependent on it. They hated it. But there was really no escape from it. So, I mean, one example is genetic engineered seed. Wheat, they said, fortunately, still it's illegal to use GMO wheat, but corn and soybeans are all GMO. And so Monsanto, you know, makes billions of dollars, millions at least, hundreds of millions, off of that, because every year you have to buy new seed that is prepared, you know, genetically for the latest version of Roundup, which you then also pay for, you know. And so farming, for many of the people we talk to, has on the one hand basically become a matter of chemicals. It's almost as if the soil doesn't matter anymore. It's chemicals, it's fertilizer and pesticides that matter. And on the other side, of hugely expensive equipment, you know, where a combine that you use to thresh wheat or corn cost $500,000, and a decent tractor costs $250,000. And so you have to be working on pretty large scale for that to happen. That actually did have one relationship to immigration, as it turns out, because immigrant labor, of course, has been very important in agriculture. It still is in the fruit and vegetable industry, of course, and in the dairy industry. The farmers, though, who were producing small grain crops with this very expensive equipment were basically saying, you know, even though it's expensive, we feel like that's the route we have to go rather than hiring immigrant labor. And if we've paid $500,000 for a combine, we're probably going to run it ourselves just to be careful about it rather than hire somebody to do it. So that also meant that these farmers were really deeply involved in the digital revolution. It was chemicals on the one hand, but it was also the digital revolution. And people ask me, well, what was one of the things that surprised me? And I've kept up on farming enough just as a personal interest coming from that background myself that it didn't totally surprise me. But I was still impressed, you know, that we were doing interviews with farmers on their cell phone while they were driving their tractor or their combine in the field, and they weren't driving it. The GPS system was driving it, you know, with a 2-inch margin through the field, and the onboard computer was measuring the soil quality every 100 feet or so and doling out the fertilizer or the chemicals according to the soil tests that were coming in. And the other onboard computer was the one that the farmer was using to check in with the futures market, you know, and talk to their brokers. I mean, it was just, you know, totally. And this was, of course, huge equipment as well. I mean, it used to be, let's say, if you were spraying pesticide in a field, you might have a machine that was at most 20 feet wide, 12 feet more likely. They had booms that were 96 feet in width, and they had radar systems, you know, on the ends of those booms to make sure that they stayed a certain distance from the soil. It was just amazing, the technology that is going on in rural America.
Do you think there's any chance that people from communities are going to buy into the multiculturalism project, or is there just no way you think they would be open to multiculturalism, or, for example, the Democratic Party, or redistributive programs? Are these people winnable to these types of propositions, or do you think there's no chance?
If you pushed me, I'd have to say no chance or very little chance, because on the political spectrum, a lot of these communities have been Republican for as long as anybody can remember, except in the South, where, of course, historically they were Democratic, but ever since the Reagan Revolution, they've been Republican. And while it's true that occasionally a Democrat wins, for instance, one of the books I did was on Kansas, and Kansas has been Republican ever since the Civil War. But Kathleen Sebelius was governor as a Democrat, and earlier in the 70s there had been two other Democrats that were governors. So it's possible there's a little swatch of purple, at least in all of these communities. But the more likely kind of political adaptation, I think, a lot of these communities, is going to be still within the Republican Party, where the real action is in the primaries, not in the general election. And you've already begun to see this year, and it's been true over the last 6 or 8 years, a little bit of that jockeying going on in the primaries between conservative Republicans and moderate Republicans, or Tea Party challengers and incumbent Republicans. And there is actually a kind of a centrist, moderate Republican in a lot of these districts that is willing to work across the aisle, willing to think about redistribution, even to some extent, sometimes thinking about redistricting, but at least being concerned about public education, being concerned about tax policies. And I think that's probably the more likely change that we would see. It doesn't mean that Democrats shouldn't run candidates in some of these districts, because there are surprises that do happen. But I do think it's more likely to happen in the Republican primaries.
I do have one more question about the book, and it has to do with place and sort of the draw of place. I remember growing up, there's always a question of, are you going to leave or are you going to stay? And if you're going to be college educated, chances are there'll be little to no jobs that you could come back to, even if you wanted to come back. But some people do choose to stay. And what's the draw? Why would people stay in distressed areas that, seem filled with disaffect, filled with rage? Why stay? Why not just pack it up and go to the city?
There's a bunch of reasons. One is that the family farm is there, and that's what they want to do. Second, sometimes, is that the family business is there, so same thing. A third is that they may have aging relatives who need their care, and they feel obligated to help. A fourth, though, is that they like the small town ambience. They like feeling like they know everybody in town. There is the kind of small frog pond phenomenon that, you know, maybe they were the star football player or the editor of the high school newspaper or whatever, and so they're known in the community, and maybe they do indeed have an extended family there. So they stay. We also talked to a fair number of people who had intentionally left the city and moved to a small town. They wanted open space. They wanted to maybe escape crime if that was a concern. Maybe they had a grandparents who had lived in a small town, and so there was a kind of nostalgia, you know, getting back in terms of back to their roots. In some cases, it was that they wanted to get involved themselves in sustainable agriculture, you know, grow a garden, raise goats, sheep, you know, whatever it might be. It's surprising, especially when the trend certainly is a brain drain for people who've gone to college and have to move elsewhere to get jobs. But there are some reasons why people stay.
I also get the sense that where you grow up is a deep part of your identity, and that's not really a small town thing. I can say kids in New York are very, very tied to this city, and it's just as hard to get them to leave town, even if there are opportunities that present themselves. And on the topic of leaving, how much of it for the brain drain do you think is a question of finding a spouse? That was always a very big issue among the college educated of my town. You know, you could go home, but it might be hard to meet somebody. It might be hard to find someone to start a family with.
Absolutely. Yeah, the marriage markets are pretty small in small towns. Yeah, they really are. And so, yes, you know, because of the life stage and everything else, when you go away to college, you're more likely to meet somebody there, and then you move on. This did turn out to be, we found, a real gender-based issue for men and women in small towns, for the women, that is, because small towns are patrilocal. They really are, because it was the family farm or the family business or whatever it was. And so it's the male spouse, in most cases, who's local, and the female spouse who's not local. Maybe she grew up in a small town, but it wasn't that town.
Right.
And maybe she grew up in a city even. And that's been a real stretch for a lot of those women, because they are newcomers, even if they've lived there for 15 years, and they're having to deal with in-laws and, you know, people that they maybe don't feel they get along with terribly well. And then especially for the women who gave up careers, you know, they were college educated, they had a career, they lived in a city, and now they were living out in the middle of nowhere. It was really tough for them, and they admitted it.
So tell us, what are you working on next?
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't worked specifically on a project on religion for a while, although religion has been a piece of these various rural and small town projects. And so I've been trying to get back into that literature. I've been working on what might become a book, trying to think through the implications of practice theory, kind of so-called practice turn in sociological theory, and what that might imply in terms of understanding religion a little bit better. So that's one possible project. Another possible project is thinking about the ways in which religious people, maybe especially conservatively religious people, have thought about the government, the federal government, in other ways over, say, roughly since the beginning of the 20th century. And the question being, why have so many religious people been so oriented towards small government as being better than, you know, larger government programs? This was an issue that came up a lot in project I did several years ago on Texas, where we were talking to clergy in Texas, and they'd say, "Well, you know, I'm all in favor of helping the poor, and I'm not a racist." Yeah. Saying so many words, you know, I want to be interracial. I want to, you know, get along with people different from myself, and so on and so forth. And yet they didn't connect the dots between their own kind of small government orientations and the fact that in order to engage in the humanitarian issues, the relief issues, the social justice issues that they were concerned with, that they needed to think about government programs that could help. And I've been puzzled about that. I know that from some of the history work I've done that it was there during the New Deal. It was certainly there during the Cold War. And I'm just curious, you know, when you think about somebody like Paul Ryan, you know, who claims, you read some of his material, he speaks at church groups, he claims to be a very devout Christian person, and yet, you know, every kind of government program that you'd think would help those issues, he's against. And so why is that? So that's something that puzzles me, and I might try working on it. Yeah.
For those who'd like to have a 10-book career, how would you what advice would you give to young sociologists, in all seriousness, to you know, to maintain the type of production that you've maintained? Do you have any tips for us?
Oh, but before he does that, I should just tell, I remember Marvin Bresler would say that when Bob first came to Princeton from Berkeley, that 4 days a week, you would just walk past his office in the hallway and you'd hear typing, typing, typing. And then one day a week, you wouldn't hear typing. And that was the day Bob was meeting with his publisher.
Which was a totally apocryphal story. I don't think I ever met with a publisher. but.
Well, I can't imagine Marvin Bresler exaggerating.
No, you can't. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, there is one piece of truth that, as we all know, you know, whether we're working on our first book or our first article or beyond that, is that time spent sitting in the chair in front of a computer, you know, has a very strong correlation with the amount of output. No question about that. But I suppose the other thing in terms of keeping it going, which also isn't too surprising, but I've certainly found it true, and that is kind of thinking ahead, you know, like 5 years or whatever. I can't think of a single project I've worked on that took less than 5 years, and some of them much longer than that. It wasn't always the front burner project, but just, you know, that time to kind of mull over ideas and say, oh, that seems like a good idea. No, that's stupid. You know, move on. Need to reformulate that. You come back to it. Oh, yeah, well, that kind of makes sense. You read something, you talk to somebody, you start doing a little bit of data collection, something works, something doesn't work. And, you know, then maybe 5 years later, it's time to sit down and actually turn that into a book. And I think that's probably pretty much what everybody does. But I think it works that way when you do that.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Robert Woodnow of Princeton University. His new book is The Left Behind, Decline and Rage in Rural America, with Princeton University Press. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. On behalf of Gabriel Rossman and Leslie Hinkson, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.